Welcome, dear listener, to Let's Dig Deeper, the podcast where we talk all about archaeology, history, art, and culture. My name is Zinat Haroon, and I am a student of classical archaeology here at the University of Copenhagen. And in this podcast, I'm going to take you along for interviews with some of the delightful people working in the field. And we'll talk with archaeologists, art historians, even just regular historians, and hopefully we'll learn more about the past in the process. Today, I'm joined by the wonderful Ingolf Thuesen. Welcome, Ingolf.
Thank you very much.
And if you might hear it on my voice, that's because it's a very cold day outside here in Copenhagen today. It's below the freezing point, so hopefully you'll be talking a lot more than me today, Ingolf.
Okay.
And you are a lecturer of Near Eastern Archaeology at the Institute of Cross-Cultural Regional Studies here at UCPH.
Yeah,
and you spend a big part of your career excavating sites all over the Middle East.
Yeah.
And now the term Near Eastern Archaeology, it comes with some baggage.
Mm.
Am I correct in saying that many scholars have now switched over to ancient Middle Eastern archaeology, or in your case, ancient Mesopotamian archaeology?
Yeah, Near East has a bias because it's less we look at something that's close to us, whoever we are. Mm. So we avoid to talk about something near or far and like that. So Middle East is better. But I think also Mesopotamia, it's a Greek work. It's actually your classical archaeologist who, I think, use that kind of a phrase. So I prefer another word, actually. I don't know what it is. Ancient Akkad or Sumer or Babylonia.
Yeah, so Mesopotamia, that's the ancient Greek word for between the rivers, so the Tigris and the Euphrates, right? So that's sort of the area that we're in today. And Ingolf, you've been all over the Middle East, let's say including Jordan, Iraq, and Syria. And you're also the head of the Danish Institute at the Damascus in Syria.
Yes.
So tell me, what's been your favorite place that you've excavated?
Oh, it's hard to say because it's any excavation is a favorite place, I think. I'm a field archaeologist, or we also say dirt archaeologist. I'm not a desktop or desk table archaeologist, so I prefer to be in the field and I enjoy every moment out there. And that's the reason why I'm an archaeologist, because I want to work outdoors. So I didn't want to be a scholar sitting in a library all my life and just inhaling dust. So I want to inhale dust out in the fresh air, so to say. Yes. so that's I was educated in Iraq as a student and learned to excavate mud brick architecture and met for the first time a real tell, these mounds that are thousands of years of habitation that are just, you have the ruins of villages, cities, so they're covered in the sand. And that's really, it's a special branch of archaeology. And that's so fascinating also because there's so many remains. And I started in Danish archaeologies and tried to excavate post holes. And then I came to the Middle East and saw what was there. And then I didn't turn around.
No, it changed your world forever.
Yeah, but I have some feeling for Danish archaeologists, but it's a little bit boring to me.
I think the prehistoric archaeologist here in Denmark would be very offended to hear,
but
we classicals and you guys.
Listen, they shouldn't listen, yeah.
Well, Ingolf, today the topic is all things ancient Mesopotamia, and most of our listeners probably know more about the topic than they might think. They've probably heard of the city of Babylon and its hanging gardens, and maybe they've even heard place names and people names like Nineveh, Nebuchadnezzar, Gilgamesh, Hammurabi, and so on. And Mesopotamia and the ancient Near East actually features quite prominently in biblical stories as well as in pop culture. So if you're a horror fan, you've probably seen the Exorcist movies where the main antagonist, Pazuzu, is based on Mesopotamian myths. And if you're Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, or you probably believe in Abraham, who was from the city of Ur. And your specialty, Ingolf, is in the early period of Mesopotamian history. So can you tell us a little bit about that time period? What is really important to know about this era of human history?
Yeah, it's a long story. I'll make it short, promise. So what's happening is really that in the ancient Mesopotamia and the West Asia, or whatever we call it, then we have this development of village cultures that develops into urban cultures, city cultures. And it's really, why do we get cities and urban lifestyle? And that's my interest in archaeology. How can the first cities in the world come out of nothing? And why does it happen? So it's the why question that's important. So some of my excavation work has actually been trying to approach that to see, can we find a good reason, explanation of why we are living in cities still today?
Yeah.
And it happens 5,000 or 6,000 years ago in ancient Iraq.
That's really interesting that a lot of cities sort of pop up at the same time in this area. And I think that's really fascinating. And I want to talk a lot more about this, so let's dig deeper. And you were talking about some of these ancient cities and how city culture first developed. And Mesopotamia can boast about having the oldest city ever that we know of, the city of Ur. And Ur is the city where Abraham is said to have come from, as well as the epic hero Gilgamesh. And what is it about Ur that makes it so archaeologically significant?
Well, I think the first reason we were attracted to the site from Europe, from the universities in Europe, that was because it was mentioned in the Old Testament, in the Bible. Mm-hmm. So the city of Abraham, of course, that's interesting for all of us, yeah. If it exists, to understand what happens and can we find these places that are mentioned in the Holy Scripts and like that. So that's how it started. Mm-hmm. But then after it developed into more scientific and not a religious minded discipline, then we were more interested in what does an early or one of the first cities in the world look like, and what define a city? What does it take to make a settlement into a city, and not just a town or village or something? Because we have in the Stone Age, we have very big villages, but they are not cities for some reasons, because in cities we find something more than just family houses, so to say.
So it's the organization of it really that,
yeah,
that
we,
it comes
we see
down
a
to.
Developed society where you have a stratified society where you have a ruling class, an elite, or maybe even slaves and a lot of craftsmen and farmers and all that. So we see the beginning of the structures we also find in modern societies.
Yeah. So the beginning of society, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's not everywhere in the modern Middle East that it's easy to excavate, like it relatively was at Ur when they first started there. And what are some of the other challenges in excavating and researching these sites today? I mean, they're both political complications, but also historical. Some, like, we don't even know where cities are. For example, Akkad, that
yeah.
is just unknown.
Yeah. And that's really a big challenge for us, that we have some of the important capitals of the past that we haven't located yet. So when you mentioned one of the most famous one, Akkad, that was the capital of the Akkadian Empire, 2350 BCE, and then for 150 years, the first perhaps empire-like structure we have in the world. And that we don't know the capital.
Yeah.
Perhaps because it's hidden under modern Baghdad. We don't know.
Perhaps, yeah. It could,
but,
it could honestly
that's
be,
up to
yeah.
you to go down and excavate and find it, yes.
That'll be my next spot on the to-do list. Go
yeah.
find Akkad.
Dig deeper.
Yeah, I'll dig deeper. I'll dig deeper. And you mentioned that society and social stratification and these things are some of the most important things probably that we have gotten from ancient Mesopotamia. And one of the other really important things that we've gotten from this ancient civilization is the art of writing, which was invented by the Sumerians. But it's not writing as we know it today. It's a type of writing called cuneiform.
Yeah.
And what is cuneiform and what was it used for? I know that they used clay tablets to write on, but how did that really work in praxis?
Well, they had to solve a problem. And that was how to record, how to make some record of transactions. For instance, when they were trading goods, it could be sheep, animals, or grains, or what from the field. So they want to have a record, because otherwise you could not go back and say, I didn't get what we decided. So,
yeah.
so there's something. It's always nice to have this kind of receipt or some system write down a kind of memory of the transaction.
Yes, and a trading tool.
Exactly. So it is an early memory. It's a kind of computer, actually. It's the beginning of computer technology.
Yeah.
Because that's memory also.
The first computer was a clay tablet. We
but
got it here.
A computer, they can also make its own calculations. That they couldn't do that on the clay tablets. But they could write down what happened in this transaction and then seal it. So it was kind of, you could also see it had not been manipulated later on. And then that's how writing developed. And then, of course, so it was all about numbers and counting and recordings. But then it turned into that you could start to write down your speak, your language. And then you could also history and even mythology, religion, ideology and all that. So suddenly a new tool developed that we still are using today.
Yeah, and
written,
probably the most significant thing that we have from them.
And they had their own way of doing that, was what you call cuneiform. That is called cuneiform because they use this kind of tool for making it. And like they had hieroglyphs in Egypt, they had cuneiforms in Mesopotamia. And it happens almost at the same time, maybe a little bit earlier in Mesopotamia.
Yeah, but very different still.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And once we move on from the Sumerian and the early dynastic period, we get to the Akkadian period. And listeners might have heard of King Sargon the Great, who made his daughter Enheduanna a high priestess, and she was actually the first known author. Sargon's grandchild, Naram-Sin, he was the first of the Mesopotamian kings to style himself as a deity. Why would he do that? Wouldn't that have caused quite a lot of tension among the other civilizations?
Oh, maybe he had learned something from the Egyptians, because they did a similar thing.
Oh.
And it's at some point, well, this is just, I cannot prove that at all, but it could have happened. That the king really wants to have total power. Then if you're also a god, then you have that power, of course.
Yeah.
So if your king is really someone that comes from the line of gods. So it's something that happens again and again, many places when you start this development of early civilization, you see that king must take this role as also being him, the divine power.
And it's this unification of both worldly power but then divine power that enables the king to hold more power here on this earth.
But it also creates some problems for the king, because if something goes wrong,
yeah.
For instance, if they have a pandemic like the COVID-19, how would you explain that as a king if you have a divine power?
Yeah, that's true.
That's because that something goes wrong. So that's my theory, that you can never find these pandemics in the ancient sources, because it was tried to hidden some way, because it would blame the king, of course.
It would put the blame on the king.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. I never thought of it that way, but that's so true, because if you're a god, why are your people getting sick?
Exactly.
So it was really just like a cover-up for him to be able to say, don't worry, guys, this never happened.
Yeah, and then it's also good if you're a king and have this expanding empire, you want to have more territory around your kingdom, then of course it's good to say I'm a god also, so I can take more land, so I can decide.
And then in the Ur III period, we first get ziggurats, this kind of pyramid-shaped building. But it's not a pyramid, is it? Like, what was a ziggurat and what was its function? Because it's not, I've been told not to say that it's a tomb, because that's definitely not what it was.
No, I would fail you to an exam if you would say that.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not, it is a temple.
It's a temple.
And it's actually a temple that's put on terraces, on platforms. And the idea is to have the temple closer to the sky, to the gods or whatever, and also have them so you can see them on long distance. So you build this small mountain. So a ziggurat was really to make a kind of artificial mountain,
yeah,
and put your temple on top of it. So everybody could see it and it could reach the sky. And you have the Tower of Babel, that's a famous one, Babylon. Of course, that was reaching too close to the sky, so God became a little bit worried
about it.
Yes, because they had nothing to do there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the humans should not take the divine power.
No, yeah. They should stay on the ground for that. Yeah.
So that's you could say that is the pyramid of Mesopotamia in some way. Like,
yeah,
we have pyramids in Mexico. They are also temples. And in Egypt, the pyramids were monuments for the dead kings. And even if they probably were never buried inside them.
Yeah, royal tombs,
yeah,
more like.
Yeah, yeah. But the pyramid shape is kind of trivial. So it's a kind of a boring structure in some way. Yes,
yeah.
Too. I think any kid who gets Lego will start to build a pyramid.
Build a pyramid themselves, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you have a lot of bricks, build a pyramid. That's what it is. And eventually the Akkadian dynasty fell and the Ur III period ended. And once we get to the Middle Bronze Age, we have actual empires. So the Assyrian and the Babylonian empires. And this is when we get really, really organized society. So not just village culture anymore, but actual society. And the Babylonians were known for being extremely bureaucratic, sometimes to such a degree that they themselves couldn't couldn't even fully handle all the paperwork, or clay work, I guess you would say. And one of the, if not the most famous Babylonian king was Hammurabi, who is often regarded as a bit of a micromanager. He was all over the affairs of his people, and he was a very involved ruler. And he's often referred to as having created the first law code, which he had immortalized on this black steel in Basel. Is this really true? I've heard rumors that Hammurabi's steel was actually just one in a series of law codes made by Mesopotamian rulers. So was it really all that revolutionary?
No, it's just the best preserved. And then that's why. So it's a famous one. Also, of course, it has a history of it was looted by Elamites that came from Iran already in the past. So thousands of years ago when they looted Babylon, attacked Babylon, looted, they took something with them. For instance, the stele, the so-called law stele. It's not a law. It's a list of consequences if you do something that has to be punished. So it's a kind of list saying if you do so and so, this thing will happen to you. And that's not really law. It's more what you say, how are you punished?
Yeah, so it's more like a list of punishments that you'll get for doing something wrong.
Yeah.
So he wasn't the world's first lawyer, is what I'm hearing.
There must have been something before. There are also something earlier, but not so spectacular as say, Hammurabi stele.
Okay. So he's just the best well-preserved law code.
Yeah, and you can now see it in Paris.
Okay, I'll go there.
So it's been looted again to Paris.
Once more, yeah. I wonder where it'll go next.
So maybe they should put down some cuneiform saying, if you loot this steel, this will happen to you.
Eternal punishment. And then there was the actual Bronze Age collapse, which was this sort of mysterious event that affected civilizations all around the Mediterranean, and it left very few records. There is, though, some evidence of an invasion by sea people. Who were these mysterious invaders?
We can never agree on that, because it's a big discussion, because there are no good sources. Many things indicate they came from the Eastern Mediterranean, Greek world, perhaps. And there was something happening with climate or a disaster, pandemic, could be, that they had to escape. Or maybe there's an eruption or earthquake. You don't know. So we know for certain that some people came in boats and they tried to settle in these areas. They tried to attack Egypt without success, but they settled apparently along the what is today the Gaza Strip, that kind of coast. And they are called in the Bible, the Old Testament, the Philistines. And you can see the word Palestine, Philistine. And that, of course, can give you a lot of speculation about what happens and what's the history. Yeah. So if that's true, if you say that the Philistines were the same as that led to the Palestinians, then they came from ancient Greece.
Then
where are we?
What exactly are we talking about then? Yeah.
So actually, Greece can claim the so-called Holy Land.
Yeah, the Greeks should come and claim their land.
And that's what Alexander did.
Yeah, that's what Alexander did. So they already did that once, actually.
It happened once. Yeah.
But then after the Bronze Age collapse, there was the rise of the new Assyrian Empire. And they were known for being really militaristic and violent, and they even depicted themselves as such. What was their deal?
It's all about resources. So they want to get more resources. And if in ancient Mesopotamia, you have, for instance, a lot of grain or wool or something, but you need metals, you need wood, good wood, and gold and all kind of stuff. So you have to. You can trade it. That's one way of doing it. That's a nice way of doing it.
That's the easy
and then
way.
You do as the Assyrians. That's north part of Iraq today. You can go out and take it and use your brutal force and just say I'm stronger than you are. So I take your stuff. Yeah.
So that was their deal.
Oh, they were very proud of it. And then again, also we can see when it went wrong. And sometimes there was a king. Actually, he called himself Sargon after the first Sargon II. He was actually killed on such a raid to the north into the mountains. And of course, a king who has this divine power, if you were killed on such a raid, bad sign.
That's a bad omen.
So his son decided to move the capital to a new
Sennacherib,
place.
Right?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And the Assyrians, they had lots of capitals.
Oh, at least four, yeah.
At least four that we know of, yeah. So that was, which ones? That was Nineveh, one of them?
Yeah,
and
that was the final one.
That was the final one, yeah.
Before that, Khorsabad, and then Nimrud, and then in the beginning, Assur. Called after the name of the main god, and Assyria, Assur.
The name of the Assyrian Empire, yeah. Okay. And then the end of Mesopotamian antiquity came about with the Persian invasion, and then the Persian Empire fell to the hand of Alexander the Great.
That's right. Yeah.
But remnants of it still lived on in these new powers. Hmm. What traces of it didn't die out?
That's a good question, because it's not so obvious when you come down to the Hellenistic period of Alexander the Great, and then we get some new powers in action in Asia, and that's, for instance, the Parthians and the Sasanians before we have the Islamic period. But then we can see in the material culture that there are traces here and there that goes back to Mesopotamian traditions. So they take from many places. For instance, one place we can see Mesopotamia clearly is in the Nabataean tribes. The Nabataean, that's a kind of Arab population that lives in the desert of Saudi Arabia and Jordan. And they built this famous Petra.
Oh.
And this is a time of the Roman Empire, actually. And when they built there, we have the rock-cut tombs today. And
yeah.
We see the architect they try to make on the facades of these tombs.
From Indiana Jones.
They use inspirations also from Mesopotamian palaces. So not the famous monument from Indiana Jones, the other tombs.
The other ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's really interesting. So some of the architectural elements really lived on in new civilizations. And now we've heard all about ancient Mesopotamia. We've been at the very beginning, at the start of city-states,
yeah.
And then we've come all the way down to when Alexander took it over and it then eventually ended. If you could travel back in time to any period in all of Near Eastern history, which would you choose and why?
Yeah, I would go back to the end of the 4th millennium BCE when we have and go to Uruk, because that's the first city we can really see, the one with Gilgamesh was the king,
yeah.
And like that. And I just want to see if it really is as we think it was.
Yeah.
Because we have our reconstructions, our ideas based on our finds from the excavations. And that's speculative in many ways. So it would be nice just to be there for half an hour and see if it really looked like
just
what we think.
Just experience it,
yes.
Yeah. Now we've come to around the end of this podcast, so what advice would you give to young students who are interested in pursuing a career in archaeology, especially in Near Eastern archaeology?
Yeah. Oh, they have to find a good university and some good professors that can also take them into the fields. And then, of course, they have to study and go and dig, not just sit in the library, go out, work there. And what I regret I couldn't do when I was a student, I never learned the language that they speak in these countries. I was forced to learn Sumerian or some ancient language, like you learn Greek,
yeah.
Or Latin, or like, I couldn't use that for anything because I was not good enough. I'm not a language person, but I should have learned Arabic, of course, because then I could speak to the people in the village where
current
we were, like, yeah,
residents,
and that,
yeah,
would have been so much more relevant to,
yeah,
me. So please learn a language, Turkish, Arabic, Persian, whatever you like.
A modern language.
Yeah, because you have to include also the local population. I don't want to be there as a remnant of the colonial period.
No.
I'm there because I want to help these countries in finding some past that we share, some heritage we share, if they want me to help them. And that's what they ask us to do. So I want to be able to share also with the local people out of the villages, because they are not the museum people from National Museum. They are just farmers or whatever they are, and they don't understand much of what's going on. And if we could speak the language better, we could include them better. And that's the future of archaeology in the Middle East.
That's a really, really great final word. But if we just have to summarize, do a quick little takeaway from this episode, what do you think that people should definitely know about ancient Mesopotamia? Someone who knows nothing, what should they know?
They should know that Egypt is not the only place that developed civilization, early civilization in the world. At the same time, perhaps even before, Mesopotamia, who is not far away from Egypt, did the same. But we don't know it because we have not been able to go there because of armed conflicts for 50 years like that. So there is a Mesopotamia that means perhaps even more to world history than Egypt and China that we know very well. So go out there and excavate.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ingolf. I feel like I've learned a lot from this. And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in to this episode of Let's Dig Deeper. I hope you've learned a lot. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, you can reach us at letsdigdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. I've been Zinat Haroon, and I am your host. You can reach me on Instagram at z_archaeology. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time where we will dig deeper into another topic. Bye!